TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Chris Hedges on Biden versus Trump and Bernie Sanders. In this interview on activism, Munich, Chris Hedges also comments on Noam Chomsky's endorsement of Biden, the mistakes of the Sanders campaign, corporate media, the power of the U.S. arms industry, the rise of fascism, and the bipartisan efforts to expand global trade that impoverishes working people. Chris Hedges is a columnist, award-winning journalist, and war reporter, a New York Times best-selling author, a professor in the college degree program offered to New Jersey State prisoners by Rutgers University, and an ordained Presbyterian minister. Activism Munich is a nonprofit and independent online media portal in both German and English. Zen Raza founded Activism in 2013 and is the senior editor. Zen Raza's questions reflect the view of the U.S. from a European perspective. And for the benefit of a European audience, he begins by asking Chris Hedges about his extraordinary past and present under Corona. Zen Raza.
Thank you guys for tuning in, and welcome to another episode of The Source, where we interview investigative journalists, former insiders, or whistleblowers. My name is Zen Raza, and today I'll be talking to best-selling author and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges. Chris's latest book is called America, the Farewell Tour. Chris, thank you so much for your time.
Sure.
You just told me off camera that you're based in Princeton, New Jersey. Could you talk about how the general atmosphere is there at the moment during COVID-19 and also how you are holding up personally at this time?
Well, since I'm writing a book and since I just got fired from Truthdig along with the rest of the staff for going on strike, it doesn't actually affect my life, my work life personally, because this is what I would be doing every day. I have a deadline in November. Princeton, which is a university town, is taking the COVID-19 very seriously. But anecdotally, it's clear that the United States is in chaos in terms of their inability to handle the virus, their lack of preparedness, their lack of coordination. It's just a disaster. I have had three close friends who have had COVID-19. One, Joe Sacco, the great cartoonist, was quite ill. Thankfully, he's much better. They were never tested. One of them was a doctor. They were never tested. It's clear that the priority among the ruling elites in the United States is to reopen the economy no matter what, which means that the virus will just come in wave after wave, cluster after cluster. The global capitalists are quite prepared to sacrifice unnecessarily large numbers of people in order to get the economy moving again. It's really appalling. The reaction by the Congress and the ruling political elites has been to throw a $1,500 check at people. Most people haven't even gotten it. It prolong unemployment benefits by a couple months. Again, the systems crash. People who have applied for unemployment benefits haven't gotten it. And then just leave them hanging while at the same time bailing out the cruise industry and the airline industry. And it's just exposes the internal rot, the political rot, the infrastructure rot within the United States that many of us, including myself, have been writing about for a long time.
I want to dive into COVID-19 and other issues later on this interview. So for our European viewers that do not know about your personal journey, I want to talk about this at this time. You spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. All in all, you've reported in more than 50 countries for mainstream outlets, including the New York Times. You were part of the New York Times team of reporters that was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 2002 for your global coverage on terrorism. Talk about your personal journey, the lessons you were able to draw from it, And then the last part of the question, why you left the New York Times?
Well, I began as a freelance reporter in Central America. I covered the war in El Salvador for 5 years. And as you pointed out, spent 20 years overseas, 15 of them with the New York Times, mostly in conflicts. I was 7 years in the Middle East. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. I covered the war in the former Yugoslavia and Kosovo. I was the Balkan bureau chief for the New York Times, always in places where there was tremendous oppression, often violence, months of my life in Gaza. I'm an Arabic speaker. And that was my career. I came back to the United States and was very vocal in my denunciations of the call to invade Iraq for all of the now obvious reasons. I'd spent, you know, months and months in Iraq. I knew the Middle East. I knew the fiasco that this would engender, not to mention the incredible human cost of these endless wars. And for that, I was eventually booed off of a commencement stage, giving a commencement address, which the trash talk, Fox News, right-wing media picked up, Rush Limbaugh and stuff. And the paper was pressured to respond, and they issued me a formal written reprimand for, quote-unquote, impugning the impartiality of the New York Times and telling me that I was not allowed to speak out about the war. And that's under, we're guild, so we're union. So you give the employee the reprimand, and then under guild rules, if the employee violates that reprimand, they can be fired. So I left the paper before they fired me because I wasn't going to stop speaking about the war. I'm going to be melodramatic, but I had people I cared about in places like Iraq who I knew would not survive, and indeed they did not, and I felt I had a kind of moral obligation to, especially as an Arabist, especially as somebody who came out of the region, to speak out against what I think is the, probably the greatest strategic blunder in American history.
A lot of European viewers, I'm talking about the general population, do not watch independent media outlets. And for example, one of the leading newspapers called the Süddeutsche Zeitung in Germany has even a cooperation with the New York Times where they publish special editions in cooperation with the New York Times. Talk about the internal workings of the New York Times and also about the general perception, your perception of the mainstream media in Germany and what European viewers should be wary about when they consume the information from corporate media outlets.
Well, having worked for many years for, you know, probably America's premier elitist publication, the New York Times, should, you know, begin by saying that I read the New York Times every day. I listen to the BBC every day. And yet, of course, I'm, as somebody who comes out of that environment, acutely aware of their deficiencies. The New York Times can do and has done good investigative journalism. It remains rooted in verifiable fact, but it also caters to both the financial and the power elites, those on whom they depend for money, i.e. through advertising and access. Access is of primary importance to a publication like the New York Times. And so when I was overseas in places like El Salvador, I wasn't working for the New York Times when I covered the war in Salvador, but this would be a good example. This certainly was in the Middle East. You would write a story off the ground that often contradicted the official narrative coming out of Washington. And the response of a paper like the New York Times is to then interview policymakers and give that their version, which was untrue, let's be honest, equal play, you know, equal length, equal play within the paper. So the readers could believe what they wanted to believe. This was classic. And for those of us, especially who covered conflicts, this was during the Reagan administration in El Salvador, or who were in Israel covering the Israeli atrocities and war crimes against Gaza, the Palestinians in Gaza, this was classic. I mean, one of the tricks that, and tricks is probably the right word, the Times would use when you reported atrocities out of Gaza is every other paragraph getting a response from the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force spokesperson in Jerusalem, even though they weren't in Gaza. And so, you know, Ahmed would be describing how the Israeli soldiers obliterated their house and shot their children when they ran outside, a rather common occurrence in Gaza. And then you'd have a paragraph from the IDF spokesman saying it's completely untrue and it's not verified in Ahmed. And with the kind of racial prejudice, I think we can't underestimate, and I know this because I covered wars such as the wars in Central America or the conflicts in the Middle East. I covered the civil war in the Sudan, Yemen, Algeria. And when people of color are dying, and I saw this when I got to Yugoslavia because they were white, there's just far more concern on the part of white, primarily white readers in the United States. So the Palestinians were just discredited from the start, and also because of the very fierce and decades-long attempt to vilify and discredit the Palestinian people on the part of Israel, the Israel lobby, and their supporters, primarily in the United States. So, yeah, the Times focuses, this is a number they use, on the top 30 million wage earners in the United States. That's why their lifestyle sections are always about, you know, the struggles of maintaining your second house in the Hamptons, or lifestyles that neither you nor I nor probably anyone watching this show lead. So, yeah, that's it. But we should be clear that the media landscape since I began in the 1980s has degraded tremendously, especially within commercial broadcasting. So you used to have a handful, I don't know what it was like in Germany, of main channels with a very boring middle-of-the-road presenter who was quote-unquote impartial or neutral, which is that is just was a kind of way that they use to give themselves credibility and attract a wider audience. That all broke down with the 24-hour news cable operations and the rise of partisan news outlets like Fox News. So everybody's become partisan. CNN's become partisan. MSNBC becomes partisan. I don't think MSNBC is any better than Fox News. And it's like what Orwell said, your 3 minutes of hate. What they do now is, rather than attempt to reach a very broad audience, they focus on a particular segment. If you're watching MSNBC, that would be a, you know, kind of Democrat with a big D, a Democratic Party. If you're watching Fox or CNN, would be the same. And it's really about selling hate and vitriol, and also turning politics into a kind of sports event. If you look at the way they set up their roundtables, it's their host with three or four commentators who can never come to agreement and always fight over stupid and inane things. It's just like the same thing we do when they do, you know, a football game. It's exactly the same. That looks the same with the scores posted behind this. It's really burlesque and very frightening because it's not news, it's entertainment. And it masks the fact that on almost all the major issues, the two ruling parties in the United States, whether that's trade agreements, imperial war, the security and surveillance apparatus, are in complete and total agreement. What they argue about is what Freud called the narcissism of minor difference. Those are largely cultural issues, which I'm not dismissing them. They're important, but they're not politics. That's kind of anti-politics. So, yeah, the media landscape has deteriorated markedly. I mean, however flawed it was, and it was always flawed when I was covering the wars in Latin America, the major networks all had bureaus and they had producers and camera people and reporters, and they went out and did a 3 to 5 minute piece. Of course, they liked the bang bang stuff, you know, and it wasn't into nuance or complexity in any way, but at least it was still a form of journalism. That's all vanished. Why is alternative media important? Well, alternative media has always been important because they're freed from commercial restraint. And so they often shame the traditional press into doing their jobs. That's precisely what WikiLeaks did. You know, why did Der Spiegel and The Guardian and The New York Times publish the cables that were courageously released by Chelsea Manning, or later the Podesta emails? It's because if they didn't, they knew the alternative press would, and it would expose them for who they are. What they did, of course, as soon as they used that material, was turn with a vengeance upon Julian Assange, who's a friend of mine and who I admire immensely, and were complicit in the character assassination that made it possible for the global security state to destroy him and now attempt to extradite him to the United States, where he will be charged under the Espionage Act, which is the equivalent of our British Foreign Secrets Act. It was passed in 1917 by Woodrow Wilson, and it was used to prosecute people who gave classified or secret information to a foreign enemy. Well, Julian Assange is not an American citizen. WikiLeaks is not a U.S.-based publication. It's a complete misuse of the Espionage Act, but is yet one more example of the kind of breakdown of the rule of law, corruption of the rule of law that is endemic now with and used by these global corporate elites. And of course, the whole trial in Belmarsh is farcical. The judge is openly prejudicial, you know, prejudiced against Assange and his defense team, ignoring, I think it's the, I can't remember, the 1993 Extradition Act, which prohibits extradition for political offense. I mean, so it's all part of the pretense of the rule of law, which gets into a whole other issue. I mean, the breakdown of the rule of law, which is quite extreme now within the United States.
This is the journalist, author, TV host, and charismatic public speaker, Chris Hedges. This interview by Zan Raza took place on May 5, 2020, on Activism Munich in Germany.
A lot of European viewers are watching the U.S. election very closely because what is decided in the U.S., whether it's NATO policies towards nuclear-armed states such as Russia or whether it's escalating with Iran, and we saw how the U.S.'s invasion in Iraq created the basis for the refugee crisis, which gave a lot of fuel to the fire, to the far right. And even things like the United States pressuring other countries such as Germany to increase their military spending, all of this affects, all of the actions of the U.S. affects European countries. So with that context, which candidate do you think, Trump or Biden, will be more favorable if they come into power towards a European perspective?
The whole project of open hostility with Russia is a Democratic Party project. For two reasons, although Trump, despite his rhetoric, hasn't been very good towards Russia. And that's because U.S. policy towards Russia is driven by the arms industry. Remember that after the fall of the Berlin Wall, I was there, actually. I was in Berlin. I was in staying in the Schweizerhof. I was there 2 weeks before the wall fell. So I was in Leipzig every day and then went on and did the revolutions in Czechoslovakia and Romania. But so after the wall fell, there was a promise made to Gorbachev that NATO would not extend beyond a unified Germany. Well, there were gigantic arms markets in Eastern Europe that if those countries became part of NATO would make and are making billions and billions of dollars to reconfigure those militaries into NATO, make them NATO compatible. And that's precisely what's happened all the way up to Russia's border. And then you have the demonization of Russia is used by the Democratic Party as a way not to address or accept their own responsibility for the deindustrialization and offshoring of jobs that have hollowed the United States out from the inside, turned most of our cities into industrial wastelands, thrust hundreds of thousands of people out of work. That was a Democratic Party problem. It was a bipartisan project, but very actively a Democratic Party project. And so Russia is used also, you know, this absurd idea that Russia stole the election is a way for the Democratic Party. And Biden was one of the major architects of all this, including the mass incarceration. We have 25% of the world's prison population. We are 5% of the world's population. Almost all of these people are poor people of color from these deindustrialized urban areas, what Malcolm X called our internal colonies. And it is really lethal, police terror, and I don't use that word lightly, coupled with mass incarceration that is the primary form of social control. All this, the 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill, all this came with Biden and Clinton. Biden used to go around bragging about how he had expanded the death penalty crimes from a handful to, I think, 50. Or I think they're up to 90 now. So the policies towards Russia will become more aggressive under the Democrats, ironically, than Trump, although the actual mechanics of what's happening vis-a-vis Russia won't change dramatically, because that's not being run by Trump. That's being run by the defense contractors who actually set the policy vis-a-vis NATO.
There's a huge debate taking place on the left. Even European viewers are watching this, and it's between voting for Joe Biden or voting for Donald Trump, who is the lesser evil. For example, Noam Chomsky has repeatedly stated that big, small differences in huge power can have large effects. And with that, I'm trying to say that he thinks that Joe Biden is the lesser evil because there is more channels available to the public to influence policy under a Biden presidency. Biden signed the Iran deal, which under Obama, and even things like that Trump did was not done under the Obama administration, which includes the arms treaty INF, which was signed to limit nuclear weapons with the ranges of 500 to 5,500 kilometers. And we also saw the complete dissolution and abolition of the climate change treaty. How do you see this? Do you think that Biden, given this track record that I mentioned, is a better president than Donald Trump, or do you view them as being part of the same coin?
Look, the ruling elites made it very clear during the election, and there were a series of articles in the New York Times where they stated this, that if primarily Sanders, but Warren or Sanders, but primarily Sanders was the Democratic Party nominee, they would vote for Donald Trump. This whole notion of the least worst only applies to us, not to them. They ensure that whatever candidate is in there, Trump, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, protects the interests of the global oligarchic elites and corporate power. Of course, they prefer Biden, just as they preferred Clinton. Trump is patently inept and a narcissist and, you know, an embarrassment to the empire. But they know full well that the maintenance of empire will be carried out whether it is Trump or Biden. I, of course, Noam Chomsky is, and I know Noam and like Noam very much, he is our most important intellectual, but he has for, you know, always repeated this mantra of voting for the least worst. In fact, what that has done in terms of those of us who care about an open society and equality and racial justice has rendered or neutered our effectiveness, because the Democratic Party knows full well that it doesn't matter what they do. We will comply. We will surrender whatever values we have. You know, the whole anti-war movement, which I was part of, collapsed once Kerry was the Democratic nominee, because we had to get Kerry elected. And so if you don't put pit power against power, if you don't put pressures on the center of power, you just move irrevocably further and further to the right. I mean, the Democratic Party in Europe would be considered a far right party. And this is the problem, that I think that the Democratic Party, or those who care about the working class within the Democratic Party, should have walked out of the party when Bill Clinton signed NAFTA in 1994, which was the greatest betrayal of the American working class since the passage of the 1948 Taft-Hartley Act. So we didn't. We didn't stand with the working class. We betrayed the working class. We busied ourselves with kind of boutique activism, inclusiveness, and multiculturalism. I'm not denying that that's all important. It is important that people have rights, whether that's gender rights or anything else. But you can't divorce that from economic justice. And so now you have given rise to these proto-fascist forces gathering around Trump, largely comprised of a betrayed white working class. And they have been betrayed. And their vitriol is especially fierce towards the Democratic Party, which traditionally had at least taken into account their interests. And so that's the problem. So if you look at it in the short term, would Biden be better than Trump? Yeah. But the fact is, the mess we've gotten into is because progressives and the left didn't stand with the working class as it was being decimated. And that working class found its voice in a demagogue like Trump. And that isn't going to change. I mean, Trump is the symptom. Trump is not the disease. I saw that in the former Yugoslavia when we vomited up these figures like Radovan Karadzic and Slobodan Milosevic and Franjo Tuđman. That's what happens when society seizes up and a cabal takes power. You can go back and look at Weimar, exactly the same kind of situation. I'm not saying that Trump is Hitler or the Nazis. That's not. But there are lessons to be learned from a dysfunctional, decayed society. And everybody forgets, which is also true in the United States, that the erosion of the rule of law in Germany was carried out by Ebert because of the negative majorities within the Reichstag, the inability to function. The legislative process didn't function. Ebert had decree after decree after decree. Well, this also happened in the United States. And of course, it's what the Nazis used to consolidate power, but they weren't the first to use it. It had been normalized. So the problem is that the political system no longer functions. It's dominated by corporate money. The legislation is written by corporate lobbyists, including the latest quote-unquote stimulus package was directed and written by corporate lobbyists. And the whole consent of the governed is a joke. Politicians need such massive amounts of money in order to run and stay in office. Where are they going to get it? It's just a form of legalized bribery. And so the danger, and I know Noam is not doing this, but the danger with reducing it to who do you vote for is to personalize a dysfunctional political system. And I, you know, I have two disagreements with Noam, and one is on this mantra of the least worst, which just frankly hasn't worked. And of course, I'm a strong supporter of the BDS movement, which he is not. But otherwise, I admire him immensely.
That was Chris Hedges, interviewed by Zan Rasa on May 5, 2020, on Activism Munich in Germany. A video of the 45-minute conversation under the title Chris Hedges on Biden versus Trump is posted on the Activism Munich YouTube channel. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, a New York Times best-selling author, a professor at Rutgers University, and an ordained Presbyterian minister. He has written 12 books, including the best-selling American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. His latest book is America, the Farewell Tour. And as you just heard in this interview, he's working on a new book due out in November. Come back for the conclusion of this conversation when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glöden. Thank you for listening.